Okay, the International Master in Health and Social Welfare has had the privilege of having a distinguished scholar, Professor Sony Pillisery, from the National Law School of India University, as a visiting scholar, coming for 1 month each year for 3 years now. And this is part of an Indian-Norwegian exchange program, a collaboration that also involves staff and students from our university college going the other way and being engaged in teaching and educational activities. And Sony, you are then involved, heavily involved in one of our courses, the course Comparative Social Welfare Theories and Concepts, where you help us to bridge these issues of comparative welfare state research and development studies. So I'm happy that we can have this conversation with you and with Professor Ivar Lødemel. You have been the one who developed this this course from I think 10 years back in time, and also you are one of the professors who are going the other way and are involved in teaching in this master in public policy in Bangalore. So I think that it would be good to have a conversation, because I think it's a very there's some challenges in this course, very exciting challenges, but nevertheless challenges that we are perhaps striving with, and certainly also I think the students will benefit for having such a discussion. So the comparative social welfare course covers a lot of ground, actually more or less the whole world. Yet most theories and concepts, they tend to gravitate towards the affluent countries of the global north. So Sony, how do you see the possibilities for going beyond this northern core when we want to understand present day social policy development?
Yeah, thanks for involving me in this small conversation. I'm very grateful that this is organized as an informal conversation. And the starting point when I reflect on this issue, that is teaching the course in comparative social welfare, at the same time back in India, I teach masters in public policy. So I keep asking the question, why am I not teaching comparative social welfare in India? And I talk a different language when I am in this context. And I am, and I think that question is at the heart of how far is social welfare as an idea imbibed into the ethic of global South, or is it more in global South? It is more the redistributive ideas are less accepted in the society, and therefore you speak very generic public policy. You don't like the term social. At the same time, here, sitting in Norway or Scandinavian countries, you have strong social democracies which have both not only in the idea of the state as well as in the society a strong element of social and redistributive ethics. So one of the ways to bridge this gap between these two concepts is to think about why such a division exists between global South and global North when we think about what are the distributive and redistributive policies and its content.
So, Ivar, you did your doctoral thesis on a historical comparison of the United Kingdom and Norway, studying the sort of early development of welfare state institutions and programs. And since then, you have been engaged in European and cross-Atlantic studies of social policy. And then more recently, you have, along with Sony, actually ventured into global comparisons, really, really global, involving countries from more or less all continents. So what have you learned about social policy theories and concepts by putting them to work on such a scale?
Well, it is very different when you apply the concepts that I was trained in my training in social policy in the London School of Economics tradition. It was no problem applying that to other European countries. When we started involving the U.S., we found that, for example, welfare is a negative term in America, while in Europe it retains the original positive connotations for the most part. So the American already there, the American welfare system was different, but still quite possible to study with the same methodologies, with the same concepts. And the challenge is greater when we come to India or Uganda or China, for example, where I've been working over the last years, where you don't have the same institutions and you don't have the same tradition. You see, for example, in India, you have the public policy, which is a tradition that's more American than European, and that is being applied. And I think you give very interesting reasons why it's a preferred term to kind of avoid the social. But it's also a challenge to bridge the social policy studies to what is being the dominant approach in countries in the global south, where you talk more about social development. It's so closely related to aid policy, to development policy, to raising, helping a poor country become a middle income country. It's so much about development. And there are scholars who argue that the social policy language and the social policy thinking of regimes and similarities, difference don't apply, while other scholars would argue that with adaptation, for example, to include family, kinship, and community to a much greater extent into the analysis, it's possible to apply the same concepts. Ian Goff is of the latter, and Jim Midgley from Berkeley could be seen as more of a proponent of the kind of social development approach.
Do you have reflections on that, Sonia? Yeah.
So this idea of when we talk about development studies, and particularly development studies as response to post-colonial experience, because the whole idea of development studies comes after the emergence of modernity in response to colonialism. Colonialism ascended and societies need to progress, and then how do you progress? It is by taking development to these released colonies or colonies which are now free. So that comes in 1950s, and you had quite 3 or 4 decades of development generation through a variety of interventions, such as food production for food sufficiency, or education, health, reduce the mortality rate. So all these have been classic development interventions. And so, yes, as you rightly said, in classic social policy, healthcare, education, housing, these have been the key focus as well. However, the key difference, as we realize, is in Europe, the social policy emerged as a state response to industrialization, ill effects of industrialization. That was not there in developing world. It is primarily agrarian society. Yes. And therefore you have a different type of social policy that you want to have there. So the vantage points, both in development studies and social policy, are hugely different. Yes. But in past two decades or so, whole development economics is in crisis, and development studies is grappling for new ideas as to where they can take development studies. For example, in context like India, when you have a very strong nationalist or populist government, they will try to imagine that we are already a developed country. We are competing with China and US. Mm. So why do you want to bring development here? So they almost kind of deny that we need development. Mm. And then what are we left with? Because you are saying, okay, you don't have a social policy, because you have no industrialization ill effects, and you are saying you don't want development studies, then where are the policies for human progress coming? What do we call them?
Hmm. Could I follow up with the question there? Because when you look at the big transitions in the development of welfare states, as we call them now, or expansion of welfare, it's often related to changes in the economy. So the European welfare state is a true child of industrialization, and it was very clear, especially in the 1800s, when Britain took the lead and Norway and other countries followed by modernizing the poor law, which was the only thing we had as an agrarian society, and now that say China has gone through this rapid industrialization and they have brought welfare higher on the agenda. I mean, with the Dibao, China after 10 years already has the world's largest social assistance program, after it was extended from just being urban to also rural, and they are now, you know, making serious leaps into health coverage, and it could be interesting to look at it as this welfare expansion going on in China, and compare that to the welfare expansion in Europe during early industrialization or rapid industrialization in many cases, and with India, that's still a predominantly agrarian society, but with a current government that says, you know, their slogan being "Make in India" to attract industry, to attract investment. There is a call for industrialization, and then that means, if they are to be similar in that sense to Europe and also to China, which is easier to compare to, then you will have more institutions. Mm. Now you have various forms of poor relief only, which is what Norway had, and in the form of 100 days work, you can work and get some pay or benefit. You have feeding programs at schools, those kind of things. But to extend beyond that has not been possible so far. And with industrialization, you would expect, for example, the 100 days work, you're entitled to work for 100 days if you're below the poverty line, which is very much based on the agricultural economy. It's about, you know, building or improving the road to the village so that they can transport things in and out. So it's kind of upholding the structure that is there. And it would be interesting to see if there are changes in policy that correspond to the ambitions about industrialization.
Hmm. Of course, India has changed quite a bit since 1980s, particularly due to liberalization and globalization that has come into country hugely. And that has done one big thing, that is, it has changed India's economic classes magnificently. Earlier used to have a situation in which a tiny rich population exists, and then you have a vast poor class existing. But after globalization, what has happened is the middle class has taken the position of about 40% of the whole economy. So you have, you can almost say, 10% of the rich class, 40% of the middle class, and probably other 50% of the poor class, to put crudely. Yeah. That kind of a classification you could have it. Which means this middle class which has emerged, they are looking up, they are looking forward for quality of services, welfare, pension, insurance. So that creates its own welfare market, or yes, market for welfare needs. Mm-hmm. And so, but that is not a state-supported welfare regime that comes up. What mm-hmm. happens is the demand is for a market-led welfare, which is taking to a very different kind of a direction in your welfare journey. Mm. Because you are not going to get space to strengthen your public services, which is badly required by the poor class. The 50% of the poor class require hospitals where doctors will come, schools where teachers will come, public supported pension system, or insurance at an efficient low cost. That will be very distant, and that sector by the state or state supported social policy will continue to be poor. It is not going to develop. But for the middle class and the rich class, it is going to be a bonanza time, and they are going to get reap the benefit of the market for the welfare that is going to come. Yeah. So that's whether the context of global south, whether they are going to progress like a European welfare state, or is it going to be more American liberal?
You're really pointing at the key challenge or difference there. Compared to India, Norway was a small and equal country, high levels of equality, hardly any feudalism before industrialization, and equally poor. People were equally poor, more or less, compared to many other countries in Europe as well. And then the more or less the whole population rose at the same time. Yeah. And you had a very good foundation there for building universal services, because the needs were shared. And nobody had the money to take off. While when you have this development, and especially in the middle income countries, where there was always a lot of very rich people, but now you also have, you probably have as close to as big a middle class also in American sense as does the US. Mm. So, and they want, they're educated in Delhi or in New York and in Oxford, and they are accustomed to other services. And in the absence of public services, certainly of any quality, they go private. So there's a huge increase in the cities. The majority of kids go to private schools, while in the country 70% go to public schools. So in the countryside, it's all public schools. So you have that the problem that maybe in terms of developing anything like a European welfare state, I'm afraid places like India are beyond the point of no return, because the large and growing middle class have already found private solutions, and therefore have no political or economic interest to invest in the the existing and emerging public solutions. So then you're back to what Titmus said. One of the things he said was that when services are for the poor only, they will always be poor services. So it's much harder to bring a good public school to India in that situation, even if there's a large proportion of the people depending on it. And maybe that's why the biggest education problem in India is that teachers don't show up. They are not the one who are, it's not the kids who are skipping school, it's the teachers. And the teachers' unions fight any attempts to fire these guys.
See, in what you are saying is correct. At the same time, to look the whole state formation from the background and backdrop of colonialism is important, because the formation of Indian state or most of the states in global south was not an organic process that happened in those societies. States were given as solutions by the colonial master. And typically, citizens, people mistrust that institution. So there is no legitimacy for the state to exist and then provide services. And therefore, the public is not created by the society as something to which I will go back and get my services or something which I trust. So that lack of systemic mistrust, or that existence of systemic mistrust, is a huge issue as to what is that meta institution to which I can go when my life is in fragility. Here, or in many of the European states, you had state as a result of your social contract, citizens coming and agreeing to have a public space to get the welfare services. So to pose the question of social policy or even social regime, to look in terms of whether a state-centric approach is appropriate when we design welfare regimes or welfare services, or should we be looking at societal institutions. So Gunnar Myrdal, who spent quite a lot of time in India, also creating the theory of the circular causation, talks about how through the economic processes you change society, at the same time how those societal process change your economic institution. So he takes the example of Indian child labor, where society doesn't give so much space for children within the Indian culture. You will not be able to have a social policy or economic policy in which you will get child rights done, because your societal processes are influencing what your economic policies will finally create. So in other words, he is pointing out how social process, social institutions overtake the state as an institution, and state's ability to regulate social processes through these legitimate institutions, because the more legitimacy is with societal institutions.
And the contrast to Norway, where perhaps you could say that the welfare state was built on equality and trust, and then produced more trust in return because people felt they got something back for their tax money, while the U.S. is something in between India and Norway in that sense.
So just as a final question, Sony, you talked about the importance of globalization, of that you're experiencing in the Indian society, and I was curious, do you think that with such in such a world of globalization and migration and supranational legislation and communication that travels at the light of speed, do you think that we should abandon the idea of you know, welfare state regimes and this sort of that some people have called sort of methodological nationalism? Can we do these analyses of one country? Does it make sense in a globalized world?
The regime approach is useful in the sense it helps us for a disaggregated understanding of what is happening. For example, country like India, we have 29 states or provinces, you can call regional states, and these states are primarily responsible for welfare institutions. So there is no one single India as a type that exists. So within India, you can see different types existing. So the regime approach helps us to kind of understand, okay, why some states are in particular type of welfare compared to another. For example, you have the state of Kerala, which has a long experience of almost like a Norwegian social democracy experience. Compare that with a North Indian state or Central Indian state like Bihar or Uttar Pradesh, where caste politics dominates, you can't see any space for social democracy for near future. Mm-hmm. But both of them are two different provinces and state within one India. Mm-hmm. And therefore, to understand these differences, how state orientations and regime orientations may be differing will be useful. At the same time, much bigger challenge is where is the kernel or where is the central point from where policies are getting made? Within country, you almost today recognize that policies may be made in Washington or policies may be made in Beijing. Do you have control over your own policies that you are making? And therefore, you see a lot of policy diffusion that happens across and people trying to pick up this as the model. And therefore, that larger process of policies getting shaped elsewhere definitely is an important frame for us to understand rather than the belief earlier that policies organically come from within.
Okay, I think we should thank you very much, Sony, for engaging in this conversation, and thanks to Eva also. I think that you two had a very good conversation, I'm sure you could talk, be sitting in this sofa couch for some time and discuss these issues, but I thank you for a very stimulating discussion, and then we of course hope that we'll see you again next year in the program. So thank you very much.
Thank you.